From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. President-elect Barack Obama went before the nation today to formally announce his economic team. For people who follow government or high finance the way many folks follow sports, this is the starting lineup. Timothy Geithner has been nominated Secretary of the Treasury. Former Harvard University President Lauren Summers is Director of the National Economic Council. Christina Romer will chair the Council of Economic Advisors. Melody Barnes is Director of Domestic Policy. In a minute, we're going to talk to someone who's been directly affected by this economic crash. But first, Keith Reed is here to give us more information on today's announcement. He's a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and his personal blog is Keith Reed's Money Corner. Hi, Keith.
Hey, Farai. How you doing?
I am doing great. So the president-elect just unveiled the team that's helping to guide him through the pitfalls of our struggling economy.
Yeah, and I think it was an interesting lineup. There weren't too many surprises, but it did give him, I think, a little bit more stability and a little bit more credibility in that it showed the direction that he's thinking in terms of what he's going to do when he announces his in the next few weeks or in the next month or so, his plan for stimulus. One of the things that Barack Obama was criticized about is whether or not he's appearing to be a little bit too hands-off with the economy. You remember, if you go back a few weeks to his election, and he said, listen, there's only one president at a time. If you watched his press conference today, he talked about the need being immediate. He talked about his team needing to get to work right away. And so now he's at a point where he wants to appear to be very much on the case. One of the other things, and I'll try to make this point quickly, is that he's also done a good job of tapping some Washington insiders, some people who are graybeards, some people who have been around, who've worked in previous administrations, who have held these kinds of posts. And he's also tapped a couple of people who are progressives. People have sort of asked Obama, you know, progressives are sort of the wing of the Democratic Party that really swept you into popularity. What are you going to do to have some presence of progressives? And if you look at Melody Barnes, much of her writing, much of her work has been from a progressive left of center standpoint. There's probably a good primer would be to read what she wrote in the Washington Post January 22nd, 2007, when she said she wrote an essay called What a Progressive President Might Say, prefacing what she would like to have heard in George W. Bush's upcoming State of the Union address at that time, had he been a progressive president.
Well, I want to hear a little bit of the president himself. Here he is from today's speech.
We have a consensus, which is pretty rare, between conservative economists and liberal economists, that we need a big stimulus package that will jolt the economy back into shape, and that is focused on the 2.5 million jobs that I intend to create during the first part of my administration.
There you saw a response, actually, to one of the reporter's questions, which was, well, you know, how big is this thing? How big is it going to get? What form is this bailout going to take? What are we really talking about? I want to talk more specifically in a second about a couple of big moves regarding Citigroup and the auto industry. But there are already starting to be these questions about what the nation has gotten itself into and how soon the president-elect will give some shape to this big blob of capital that really is, you know, what's going on through the government.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to have to at some point be very blunt. And he also telegraphed this today during his speech that he understands that there. I think his direct wording was that he's going to have to go through the federal budget line by line, looking for places where there can be cuts. I actually blogged about it this morning on Keith Reed's Money Corner that this is at some point. He's going to have to say how much this is going to cost, and more to the point, where is that money going to come from? I mean, you're looking. We already don't know where half of the original $700 billion economic rescue plan went. We don't know where that money is. Detroit came to Washington last week hat in hand and went back empty-handed, but we'll likely come back again. Citigroup is about to get $20 billion. We've seen what happened with AIG. President Bush has already said today that during his lame duck term that we still might see more rescue packages for individual companies that take the shape or form of Citigroup. And what Barack Obama is proposing, very necessary to do stimulus, very necessary to create some investment from the public sector, from Washington, in creating new jobs. But just where in the world is the money going to come from? He's going to have to answer to that. He's going to have to answer for that in detail and pretty quickly.
Now, when you look at the government agreeing to take this $20 billion stake in Citigroup and then the relatively cold shoulder that came from the visit of automakers to Washington, D.C., why the difference?
You know, there was a lot of discussion of this on some of the Sunday morning talk shows. And one of the points that came up was, you know, there's just a difference in how people tend to view blue-collar workers, blue-collar companies, when they come hat in hand saying, listen, we need to be saved, and white-collar ones. And you can, you know, pontificate all you want about the reasons for that. But I think people have a different vision of Detroit, a different vision of manufacturing. It's an industry that has a reputation of very aggressive labor unions. There are many sectors, many people who are involved in economic policy who are against labor unions, who don't like that structure. There's been talk for the longest time of you know, Detroit, of the auto industry being a business that needs to get its act together. And I think a lot of that impression carries over when you look at some of the reality over the last few. And actually, you and I have talked on this show about some of the concessions that auto workers have made over the last 2 years or to 18 months. Many of these auto workers are already given up a lot. Many of those labor contracts have already been modified, even if those modifications haven't yet taken place. And so what the auto industry is saying is that, look, we're doing our best to get our act together, but we need to be able to survive into the point at which those new labor agreements are enforced, to the point at which those things that were cut can actually be put in place, and when we can get our cost structure in line. But if we don't survive into that point, you're going to talk about the loss of millions of middle class blue collar jobs across the heartland of the United States. And that's something that, you know, Washington is going to have to make up its mind on whether or not it can afford to allow that to happen.
All right, Keith, I want you to stay with us, but we've got someone else right here in our studios at NPR West, Los Angeles resident Julia Cox. She holds a college degree and has spent years working white-collar jobs, but she's been looking for work since January, and you came in to visit with us and talk about your journey. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It would seem like, you know, everything would be life on a platter. You went to the University of Southern California, correct?
That's correct.
That's a pricey, very highly sought after school. And what did you do after that?
Initially, when I graduated, I had entered into the staffing industry for about 5 years. I was affected by 9/11 and was laid off not long after that. And then I had entered into the mortgage industry and had been in it ever since.
How many years was that?
Over five.
So when you think about what you did, it clearly you were providing a service for 5 years, or else you wouldn't have had a job that long. What specifically did you do?
I was a wholesale mortgage account executive, first for Greenpoint Mortgage, and lastly here with Aurora Loan Services, the wholesale mortgage arm of Lehman Brothers.
So I just want to, you know, for the sake of full disclosure, note that you are actually the niece of our host correspondent, Tony Cox, and we're very grateful that you could come on with us. There's no family that hasn't been hit by this, but when it comes to you and your individual life, what are the ripple effects of being out of work this long?
Well, you know, I've lost my home. I've had to move in with family as I look for work to try to get back on my feet. So it's had a major effect. Taking care of my children, oldest daughter in college, where initially I was paying cash for education because she couldn't afford to or didn't qualify for any federal or student aid, which now she does. But just not being able to take care of things that I've always been able to take care of, no longer able to do that.
I'm going to come back to you in a second because I really want to explore your story more. Keith, there's something that we hear a lot called discouraged workers, and that's people who've given up. We're sitting here with Julia, who hasn't given up, but it must take a lot to just keep going and going. Do you think that we're going to see a lot more discouraged workers in the coming months?
Yeah, you're definitely going to see a lot more discouraged workers. We've already seen many more discouraged workers. And one of the very difficult things that happens is when you see so many people hit the unemployment rolls, after a certain point, the economists stop counting them, because these are people who have been looking for a job for a significantly long amount of time. And then they say, you know what, I'm not going to look anymore. I need to figure out some other way. And they stop showing up in the unemployment statistics. So there's a percentage of that pie of people who are not in the workforce who stop being counted. And then you start to see a little bit of drop off in terms of the services that those people get or the resources that are available to people who are out of work, because you don't see the counting of everybody as they should.
Let's jump right back into this. Julia, you mentioned you lost your home. How did it unfold?
I wasn't able to make the payments anymore. And what I had done is I'd gone ahead and listed it to try to at least do a short sale. And fortunately, the kind of home that I had was a bargain for anyone that could afford to purchase it on a short sale. So I was fortunate enough to at least do the short sale, but it still takes about 4 months, and we're still in negotiations. But fortunately, it's not a complete foreclosure, but it is over a 50% loss.
So let's talk about some of these terms. And Keith, I would love you to help us. Keith, I'm going to name one of the terms she brought up. Tell me what it means. Short sale.
Short sale is essentially what happens when your house is what you call underwater. You own a house, but you can no longer sell that house for more than for at least the amount that you owe back to the bank. Or more. Okay, so you're not going to make a profit, and you're actually going to sell that house for less than you owe the bank. And essentially, what you have to do is you got to go to the bank and say, listen, you know, I'm in a position where even if I'm able to sell this, I'm not going to be able to repay you the money. And the bank has to actually agree to that, because of course they're holding a note and they want to be paid back. And that's why, as she alluded to earlier, that it takes a little while, because you have to a bank is going to put you through something of a process before they agree to you selling a house and them with their because what essentially what they're agreeing to is okay, you're going to walk away from this deal and we're not going to get all of our money back.
Explain to us bankruptcy, and I know that actually didn't come up formally, but were you trying to avoid bankruptcy?
I am.
You're in bankruptcy.
I'm not in bankruptcy, but I'm trying to avoid it.
You're trying to avoid it. Mm-hmm.
But it's right on my back door.
Yeah, yeah. Why would someone, Keith, try so hard to avoid bankruptcy when the cards are stacked pretty hard against you?
Well, there are a lot of reasons to avoid bankruptcy, and really very very few to want to go into bankruptcy. I think people sort of view filing for bankruptcy, and when you say bankruptcy, what essentially you're talking about in most cases is a Chapter 11 filing, where you are protected to a certain extent from certain debtors coming after you. Until such time that you can restructure your finances and be able to pay them back. If you go through a chapter seven, that's when you're saying, you know, listen, I'm broke and I'm not going to be able to pay anybody back, and I need you to wipe. I need the court to legally wipe the slate clean. In either instance, it is a huge hit to your credit rating. It makes it very unlikely that for a period of at least 7 years or longer that you're going to be able to borrow money. And if you are able to borrow money, you won't be able to do so at favorable terms whatsoever. You're going to pay very high interest rates on any credit cards that you get, on any loans that you get. You're going to face significant scrutiny. We also know that everybody from insurance companies to employers are also looking through at people's financial and credit histories now. So filing a bankruptcy is not something that you go into lightly, because it can actually make the difference between whether or not you're actually able to get a job in the future. And if you're already in some financial trouble, I mean, that has obvious implications.
I want to go back to you, Julia. At this point, how do you go about job hunting? What are your means, whether it's newspapers, friends, Craigslist? What are you doing?
It's all of those. And right about now, it's who you know and not what you know. But Internet applying and applications and friends. I even call HR departments directly. And, of course, they don't take the calls because they're getting a large volume of calls from people looking for work. Employment agencies, everything that I could use, that's what I'm doing.
Why do you think you haven't had more luck?
For Southern California, I've been told that there are some employers that didn't want people in our industry or with our experience, the mortgage industry experience. Specifically, when you're trying to transition into another sales opportunity, it's almost as if we didn't count, or the kind of work we did wasn't real sales almost.
Do you feel taken advantage of in any way, only in the sense that the job that you had may not have given you the life experience that you hoped that would translate?
Yes, to some extent. I feel like the experience that I had and the work that I did, I mean, it was legitimate, good, hard work. I mean, it wasn't the kind of work where people think we were ripping people off, if you will. The work that was involved, it was honest work, and so it's sales. And so when you're transitioning, either you're a sales professional or you're not. Gadgets or widgets, you can sell it. And so I don't think any of us in our industry thought it would be a hard transition into another sales type of opportunity.
Would you consider moving?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The United States is open to me. I'll go anywhere to work.
Mm-hmm. Keith, there are all sorts of articles that come out and say, you know, best place to retire. I know Black Enterprise just had one of those. But what do you consider the options of people who are willing to pack up and leave? Should folks consider different parts of the economy? And if so, where would they go?
I think you absolutely have to be willing to consider different parts of the economy, and you have to be willing to consider different geographies. Listen, this is a crisis, and it's been repeated so often that it's cliche that this is the worst economic crisis since, you know, name it, since the 70s, since the early 90s, since the Great Depression. But in large part, it's true, at least if you're looking at the what sectors are growing. There are simply very few sectors of the U.S. economy that are expected over the next 12 to 18 months to add jobs. There are some that may stay flat, but most industries, most sectors are contracting. And so if you found some, you know, some niche, some place where there's hope, you need to be willing to move if you're absolutely able. But right now, it's going to be tough. I mean, it's very difficult for me to think off the top of my head of any one sector where there's expected to be very much growth. And that's because so many different parts of the economy are tied together. I mean, if you think about where her career was, and one of the things that she said is I believe that she began in the staffing industry, correct?
That's correct.
If you Well, if you're in staffing today, I mean, there's not going to be a job there. Nobody's hiring. You're not going to, you know, a headhunter, somebody who's in an HR function. Many companies are these are the exact kinds of jobs that are being laid off. She went into a sales role, so you know, whether it's mortgages or it's cars or anything else, look at what's happening to salespeople. Companies aren't growing. They don't need more salespeople. I mean, you know,
Before we let you go, Keith, what is the one piece of good concrete advice that you can give Julia?
The one piece of good concrete advice that I would give Julia is that she's on the right track with her, you know, with her mindset, that she's willing to move and she's willing to look at other sectors. I mean, with today's economy, with the projections for job growth, which, you know, really is another way of saying that there aren't any projections for significant job growth. You've got to be flexible. You've got to be willing to look at other industries. You've got to be willing to look at other parts of the country. You've got to be ready to pack up and go and do something different and not be afraid of it. And I think she's on the right path there, so long as she's, you know, open to whatever opportunities might come might become available to her.
Well, I want to thank both of you for coming in, and Julia especially, for sharing your story.
Thank you so much.
We were speaking with Julia Cox, a college-educated mother of two who's been looking for work since January, and Keith Reed, a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. He also blogs at keithreedsmoneycorner.com. It's been alleged that al-Qaeda's number two in command called President-elect Obama a House Negro, and African-American turnout was high for the presidential election. But will African-Americans turn out in force for a December 2nd runoff? We've got these stories and more on our bloggers' roundtable with Sean King from the blog Sean in the City, Kimberly Coleman, who blogs at sistergirlspeakup.blogspot.com. She's also a political commentator for Progressive Blend Radio, an online radio show, and Harry Allen, who maintains the blog Media Assassin at harryallen.info. Hi, guys.
Hi, Farai.
So, as we mentioned last week, there was some controversy over a message from a top al-Qaeda deputy. It was initially reported that the operative referred to Obama as a House Negro, but now it's been reported that he called Obama a White House Negro. Could this be a case of a statement that was lost in translation? What do you make of it, Harry?
I think it's entirely possible. I remember when the president of Iran spoke at Columbia, there was a number of statements that he made that were controversial. And then if you read some of the reports about the translation, it was a question as to what people were actually, if what people were saying he said was actually what he said. So I think there is certainly an issue we have, as well as fighting many people from this part of the world, understanding what they're actually saying.
At one point in the tape, al-Zawahiri calls Obama a traitor to his race and compares him unfavorably to what he called honorable black Americans like Malcolm X. Kimberly, you know, there's this whole set of racial dozens that get played around who's black enough and who's not black enough. Were you surprised to see it played by people who are totally outside of the African-American cultural context?
I think it was shocking because you've seen this upsurge of people who are so excited about Barack Obama. It's as if he has become a world president. I talked yesterday to someone in Germany and who traveled to England, and they both said all that people want to talk about is Barack Obama. What I think is the frustration with al-Qaeda is that because Barack Obama has become sort of this quasi-world president, that it is diminishing their recruitment tool, which was George W. Bush. So it's changed the dynamics of how they recruit people now, because the person that's at the top of, you know, who they recruit for is now leaving the office as of January 20th.
That's a great point. It's like everybody says, yeah, I like this guy. Mm-hmm. So what have I got to be mad about?
Exactly.
Yeah. And in fact, you had that whole moment, Sean, where you had one al-Qaeda operative basically saying we'd be excited about a McCain presidency because it would bring more people over to our side. So I think we have to be very careful here about ascribing people's motivations. Do you think that there will be, in general, a diminishment in the motivation of people who are terrorists now that you have new leadership in the U.S. or Harry? Is that not going to matter ultimately? We still.
Well, I think it will. You know, I think Kimberly really nailed it. I think the rallying cry for al-Qaeda for years has been, we hate George W. Bush. And Barack Obama puts to death so many of the problems that they had with George W. Bush. I'm just shocked that the best criticism they had was calling him a house Negro. I mean, it's not creative. It's historically ridiculous. I had to ask myself, since he kind of brought Malcolm X into the picture, would Malcolm X call Barack Obama a house Negro? And I don't think he would. I mean, Barack Obama had great relationships with several people in government positions. And even comparing Obama to Malcolm X is kind of ridiculous. Malcolm X was a leader of a very small, narrow group of people. Barack Obama is president of the United States. And so it's a faulty comparison. And I don't know if he thought he was going to strike a nerve with black folk around the world or people of color around the world, but it was really ridiculous.
I think actually it was a very smart move. I think it got him on the front pages for a period of time. And I don't think that al-Qaeda's issue was with George Bush per se. I think al-Qaeda was able to make an issue with George Bush because so many people had a problem with George Bush. But when you look at the statements that they've made about why they're doing what they're doing, it isn't tied to any particular administration or president. It has to do with a fundamental issue about how the United States interacts with the Arab world and their vision of the caliphate.
When we look ahead to the foreign policy issues affecting this presidency that we have coming up, many people have said that, you know, the issues are going to hit pretty quick of how you balance the promise to get out of the war in 16 months with the promise to now create tens of millions of new jobs. Those are both two very deep promises, and they're not necessarily in opposition, but they may be in opposition in terms of how much time the president can spend on them.
And Sean, they would both radically transform the society at present.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, I'm going to go to you, Sean. Do you think that there are going to be issues in dealing with these issues of foreign security, including terrorism, and then dealing with the economy at home?
Absolutely. I mean, it's going to be tough, but I think what Obama is doing, and I even see today the markets are going up. They went up on Friday. He's trying to put the best, most capable people, people that do have big egos, big leadership quotas, he's trying to put the right people in the right places to kind of manage the economy, to manage national security, to manage foreign affairs. And so he's bringing the right people to the table. There's so much for him to do. He knows he can't do it all by himself, and so I think he's bringing from either Jim Jones with national security, or today we saw Geithner and Larry Summers and others dealing with the economy. This is not something that one man could do by himself. And so I think people are starting to feel at least a little more comfortable knowing that you may have someone like Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton who have great world travel, and they do come as a team, whether we like it or not, dealing with international relations. So Obama is picking the right people to be in leadership, and so he's definitely going to have to manage all of these things. It's going to be difficult, but I'm encouraged.
All right, guys, we need you to stay with us. We are going to take a break and come back and talk a little bit about Saxby Chambliss and a race there, a question of whether or not black folks will turn out. We've got more with our bloggers, plus next on News and Notes, if you were in an abusive relationship, where would you go to get good advice? Many women go to their hair salons. In a few minutes, we'll talk to the founder of the program, Cut It Out, Salons Against Domestic Violence. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We're back with our bloggers roundtable. With us today, we've got Sean King of the blog Sean in the City, Kimberly Coleman, who blogs at sistergirlspeakup.blogspot.com, and Harry Allen, who maintains the blog Media Assassin at harryallen.info. So, guys, I'm going to pop right back into the politics, domestic politics this time. The U.S. Senate race between Republican Saxby Chambliss and Democrat Jim Martin in Georgia is going to a runoff. The incumbent, Chambliss, didn't get 50% of the vote. Now, African Americans turned out in large numbers to vote early for the presidential race, but this could be a case of much lower black turnout. Democrats are just two seats shy of the 60-seat filibuster-proof majority, and some say a visit by President-elect Obama is the only way to recreate the base turnout on November 4th. Kimberly, how do you see this shaking out, particularly with the black vote?
This is one of the things that concerned me in the election, that if Barack Obama didn't win, how would the Democratic Party rejuvenate the black vote and the youth vote and the new voters? Well, now we see that they're going to have to do that a little sooner than the mid-year elections 2 years from now. I think that Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Bill Clinton should return to Georgia to rejuvenate that black vote. I think that a visit, if the seat is worth it to him, especially if Al Franken wins in Minnesota over the incumbent Norm Coleman, to get that 60 votes, if it is that important to him. Some people say that he doesn't want to make that trip to, you know, risk his reputation in case there is a Democratic loss.
Sean, you're in Atlanta. Why do you think Barack Obama hasn't had perhaps as much traction in Georgia to begin with?
Well, Barack Obama's got great traction in Georgia. Actually, I mean, I know he didn't win the state, but it was a very narrow loss. I mean, it really surprised me that it was as close as it was. I understand the argument that people want him to come here, but I find it very unlikely that Jim Martin's going to win that race. If Jim Martin lost with all of the black vote, it's going to be very, very difficult for him to win. But the truth is that turnout is low on both sides of the aisle. I mean, people here in Georgia really have political fatigue right now. I mean, the commercials are going nonstop, and so people are really turned off, I think, by the race altogether. And I think Barack Obama also doesn't want to lower himself and kind of get into this very messy political fray, and even like Kim said, and then come here and campaign for someone that may lose. The truth is, though, that I think the Democrats really already have a de facto 60-person vote in the Senate. There are several very moderate and even kind of left-leaning Republicans in the Senate that are going to give them that 60-vote filibuster with some tough issues.
Harry, do you feel as secure about whether or not the Democrats have a filibuster-proof majority?
Well, I think the thing that this really makes clear is that what we just saw, the race before November 4th, was not about Democrats and Republicans. It was about Barack Obama. Barack Obama was the new brand, so to speak. And I think this also raises a question about the ongoing queries as to what Barack Obama is going to do with this incredible infrastructure that he developed to win. Like, is that going to be put in some way to new uses or to uses like this?
All right. I want to move on to something that I'm sure you have plenty to say on, all of you. But, you know, all right, I'm going to start with you, Harry Allen, media assassin. You've worked in the past with a lot of folks in hip hop, but particularly my favorites, Public Enemy. Now, the Philadelphia hip hop band The Roots is going into semi-retirement. They are reportedly going to be the house band for comedian Jimmy Fallon when he takes on Conan O'Brien's late night talk show.
Wow.
The Roots are known for hits like You Got Me, featuring Erykah Badu, and What They Do. Harry, if this is true, is this a good move for The Roots?
I think it's a great move for The Roots. I've known the members and have written about them and reviewed their records and for years. I met Amir before the band was really very well known at all, and we've maintained a good relationship. And I couldn't think of anything better than being on TV every single night in terms of increasing one's visibility and the knowledge about one's name and of one's music. And I think that they're going to do incredible work. And if this is actually going to take place, I think it's a great choice and a very smart one that Jimmy Fallon is making.
But Kimberly.
Absolutely.
Let me get Kimberly here for a second. I mean, do you think, though, that this is, you know, now that you can hear, for example, the Buzzcocks in a car commercial, and people who like punk rock and people who like new wave will hear those songs all the time. Is this, in a way, do you have mixed feelings about them becoming a house band as opposed to being one of these stalwarts who really have fought the music industry hard to be themselves?
No, I think it's excellent. When I first read it, I thought back to, you know, when I first listened to Rapper's Delight. And I remember being in the car and, you know, my mother said, this will never last, you know. And now, you know, many years later, it's the only thing my mother's probably been wrong on, by the way. But it's, but
that's
a nice thing to say.
Yeah.
But I mean, just thinking back to that and seeing, you know, even Sugar Hill Gang on D.L. Hughley's show a couple years ago. I think it's great. I think it really puts, you know, hip hop in the forefront again. And although that show is a little bit past my bedtime, I will be so inclined to tape it or TiVo it, as it were, if it is true.
Sean, everyone else is excited. What about you?
Well, you know, when you said mixed feelings, I hadn't really thought of it like that, but I hear you. I wish the Roots were selling out stadiums all across the country. Everybody knows that they're that gifted and talented and skilled and unique, but considering the turnout and the reception that they get, this is a phenomenal opportunity. I hope this boosts their career. You know, I don't see it as a step down. I mean, it's a great opportunity. I mean, like Harry said, being on TV every night, increasing your visibility to a national audience, Jimmy's really popular, and so his show may do well, and I know he's going to really feature the Roots prominently. So, I mean, it could be a great opportunity, but I don't see it as like they're having to lower themselves to do this. I mean, this is a good opportunity for them, and hopefully more people will be turned on to what they're doing.
Yeah, they're going to definitely transform the position as opposed to having the position transform them.
Yeah, absolutely.
I always thought it would have been a good idea if Dave Chappelle had done that. I mean, I know he had different, you know, people from the Roots on, yeah. Especially the drummer. But I always thought that would have been a really good idea to, like, end his show, you know, with the Roots on there.
Well, it's funny. It makes me think of the Chris Rock show back when he had a variety show. Music was a huge part of that.
Yeah, so, Grandmaster Flash is his mm-hmm. Band.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. It was a DJ, Grandmaster Flash, one of the legends, but... having a band on in this capacity, it sounds like you're all for it.
Yeah, it's great exposure for them.
These guys are super talented, they're just super talented and super creative and super imaginative. So it's going to be really just something to see, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right. On that note, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Farai.
We were talking to Sean King from the blog Sean in the City. He joined us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Kimberly Coleman, who blogs at sistergirlspeakup.blogspot.com. She joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Harry Allen, who maintains the blog Media Assassin at harryallen.info. He joined us from NPR Studios in New York. If women are being abused at home, getting them to spend healthy time with people they trust is key. For some women, visits to their hair salon become regular times to open up and share what's in their hearts. Diane Mooney was a community volunteer 8 years ago when she started a program to help beauty industry workers in Alabama spot signs of domestic abuse in their clients. The program is called Cut It Out, Salons Against Domestic Abuse. Diane Mooney is here to talk about the program. We also are joined by Marcia Hamilton, a celebrity hairstylist working here in Los Angeles, California. Hi, ladies. How are you?
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. So, Diane, first of all, Cut It Out. What is the basic premise of how you work?
Well, the program was started actually in 2001 as a statewide initiative. We were given some funding from our Attorney General to create a program. The Women's Fund of Birmingham started a program in which we would train salon professionals to spot signs of domestic violence and very carefully refer them to local resources for help. And so it really started as a statewide initiative in Alabama in 2001. And in 2003, I was able to take the program national thanks to funding from the company that I represented, Southern Living at Home. And so since 2003, it's been a national program. We're operating in all 50 states, and we're helping an enormous number of people. And it's been tremendously exciting to see the growth.
Was there anything, you know, have you been able to help anyone, Diane, first of all, where really you think it's made a difference in the long run to their life?
I absolutely know that we have communicated with the National Domestic Violence Hotline number, which is located in Austin, Texas, and it's the number that we ask all victims to call this number. The salon professional simply recognizes these signs of domestic violence in their clients and responds by referring them to the National Domestic Violence Hotline number for help. They're in no way giving advice or counseling them. But, you know, in a salon, it's a very intimate environment. And so much is disclosed to the salon professional because they trust that person. It's a relationship that's built up over time. There's touching involved. It's a place where she goes, the client goes, where the perpetrator does not go. And so, you know, you remember the movie Steel Magnolias. It's about how women talk and disclose very often their darkest secrets.
Marcia, you are in Los Angeles, and you're not affiliated with this program, but there was a time when you had to recognize that one of your clients was going through domestic abuse. Tell us about that.
How are you doing, Farah?
I'm doing great. It's great to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Basically, my client, she's been a client of mine for years, and just, you know, one day casually, and I say casually because I was kind of shocked at the way she disclosed to me. She was just explaining the issues and the problems she was having in her relationship. And, you know, she just threw it out there, like, if he hits me one more time, I don't know what I'm going to do, and I don't know how to make it stop. And I was kind of, like, thrown off by it, and I was very, very angry because I felt what I told her was, if I was telling this story right now, I would be on the witness stand telling the story, because it's not cool. It's not right to have your spouse or to have your significant other abusing you. And I find that a lot of times when there are things going on in our clients' lives, they come to us and they let us know, but then it's kind of hard for us. There's only so much help I feel that I can give, because I can give the advice, I can give the information, I can give examples, and I have tons of examples of knowing of women who've been abused. But after that, once they leave the salon, then it's kind of, you know, in 2 weeks they come back and I get another story.
Do you believe that calling in to the national hotline is enough to change a woman's mind?
Sometimes I don't think it's enough because of the many examples that I have seen. I think women change their mind when they feel like their life is in jeopardy. That's when it's a wake-up call for them, when they feel that their life is totally, completely threatened and they can't hide the bruises anymore. When it becomes like totally obvious to the general public or their friends or their family, I think that's when they finally kind of like, you know, wake up and think, okay, I've got to do something about this. And I feel there should be more outlets for women to talk about abuse or to report abuse, because I don't often see like too many ads for it, or, you know, hear people talking about it, because it's one of those things that's kind of taboo. It's not really talked about.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons that Cut It Out was started. It's really an attempt to bring light to the very dark subject of domestic violence. And in our program, we talk about how it's not the fault. It's not their fault. Help is available. You're not alone. And by calling the hotline number, we know that there's been a significant increase in the number of calls thanks to Cut It Out. And it refers the victim to local resources for help. So, you know, it gives perhaps the YWCA or the local shelter, because honestly, so often women do hit bottom, as Marcia was saying, and can't do it alone. She needs help.
Do you do anything that is steering people culturally? And I'm asking you, Diane, if when people call into the network, sometimes people feel that they're more comfortable with someone who knows their background, whether it's a racial, ethnic, just the kind of way that they grew up. Do you know if the hotline tries to reach out to people and pair them with counselors who can really understand where they're coming from?
Yes, I think there's a great deal of focus on cultural compassion, and I know that that all of our training and service providers are available to speak Spanish, because so often language is a barrier. I know that the incidence of African American women is higher. The incidence of domestic violence is actually higher among African American women. But, you know, research is inadequate, but we do know that intimate partner violence is 35% higher than with other cultures in the Black community.
Marcia, based on what you have been doing in terms of looking at your clients and trying to provide them with some counsel and some resources, do you think things are getting better?
I would think so. There's a magazine I get at my salon called American Salon, and I try to refer my clients who do tell me about the abuse. There's usually a number about every 2 months they post a full page ad in there for help for abused mm-hmm. women. And like I said, it's only a certain percentage that come out and say it, so it's kind of hard for me personally, being a person behind the chair, to gauge whether it is getting better or not. It's kind of hard for me to keep track of those numbers.
All right, ladies. I appreciate what you've told us so much. And we were speaking with Marcia Hamilton, celebrity hairstylist here in Los Angeles, and Diane Mooney, founder of the program Cut It Out, Salons Against Domestic Violence. She joined us from the studios of WBMH in Birmingham, Alabama. You can always go and find out more about our show at nprnewsandnotes.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium.